It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we look at a modern miracle, how we Americans have the cheapest groceries in the Western world. Now, I know it's hard to believe right now, but it's true. Our guest sees this system as a doomed paradox. Now, he's journalist Paul Roberts, and his book is entitled, not surprisingly, The End of Food. Well, this is the week we arm you with power over your food. Two food scientists, Harold McGee and Shirley Currier, arrive each with a neat bag of great tricks. And I'm once again challenged in a new round of Stump the Cook with celebrity stump master Christopher Kimball of America's Test Kitchen fame. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll out the show with Jane and Michael Stern. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
You know, Lynn, back in 1983, Jane and I were eating our way around Philadelphia, and we happened upon a place called the famous 4th Street Delicatessen. And at the time, the proprietor was a guy named David Auspitz. And what he told us is that this is a living museum. You can bring your kids here and see what a real delicatessen is like. And boy, was he ever right. He's no longer the proprietor. But today, if you go to the famous 4th Street Deli, it's like a trip back in time. It's like a classic old East Coast urban delicatessen with these big, beautiful pastrami and corned beef sandwiches that are made in proportions that verge on ridiculous. I mean, there's a normal size sandwich, which is large, and then you can also order your sandwich what they call zaftik, which of course means big, actually comically big. It's one of those sandwiches that you cannot pick up in your hand and your jaw won't stretch to include the whole thing. But the main part about it, I had the corned beef, and what needs to be said about the corned beef is that it not only comes in abundance, but it is really delicious. What the waitress who brought us the corned beef sandwiches said that the corned beef, the meat, comes from Chicago. But once it comes from Chicago, the guy who runs the place now spices it and steams it himself for hours. And that's clearly the secret, because this corned beef is especially spicy, like really zesty corned beef, and tender beyond belief. What's so great is that it's minimally fatty. You know, it's got enough fat, so it's really juicy, but it's mostly meat. There's very little actual fat in it.
So they're corning their own beef.
Yeah, exactly. And that makes all the difference.
You know, Lynn, sometimes when I go to a deli like the famous 4th Street, I get almost worried, because when I was a kid, that type of urban Jewish deli was everywhere. And they're getting harder and harder to find. And this place, as Michael was saying, is like a museum of deli history. It's got the colossal sandwiches, the matzo ball soup, the noodle kugel, you know, the stuffed cabbage drenched in sweet and sour gravy. And it almost scares me that, you know, maybe in 25 years, these places will not exist anymore.
But that's all the more reason to eat at them often now.
Exactly,
and not,
right.
And not miss a mouthful of all the glories they have to offer.
And one of the glories that must be pointed out, in addition to the traditional deli stuff, is chocolate chip cookies. Now, you don't normally think of a deli as a source of great chocolate chip cookies, but the cookies from the famous 4th Street Delicatessen are spectacularly good in a normal way, by which I mean they're not huge cookies, they don't have an overabundance of chocolate chips, but there's something about the perfect balance between crispness and chewiness, and also something in the batter. I find it's almost intoxicating. It's almost as if there's something fermented in the batter. I mean, obviously there is not, but there's something about these cookies that is dizzyingly good. Maybe it's the chocolate. I don't know what.
Well, that's usually what delis lack, is a good dessert.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember sponge cake, maybe, or a bite of halva or something.
Yeah, but nothing more.
Yeah, this deli is very smart to have a very, very singular good dessert.
So what is the place like?
It's very nostalgic looking, but not in a cloying way.
It's got that great, like, old-fashioned black and white tiny tile floor, probably from the 1920s, 30s.
Well, the place was opened in 1923, and it still has these old cabinets in back. I think they're non-functional anymore, but they're these beautiful kind of old mirrored cabinets that look like a refrigerator from the 1920s. The other thing that has to be said about it is that the walls are plastered everywhere in true Delhi style with signed pictures and posters and autographed things from the celebrities. Oh, yeah. You know, known
celebrities you've never heard of.
who love the place.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you know you can hear the Sterns here every week, but you can check out their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, I have got a little grammar spelling lesson here for food writers, publishers, and newspaper editors. And my friends are laughing right now because they know my spelling. But trust me on this one. People keep messing up. Lasagna ends with an E. Not the way everybody spells it now, with an A. Why? Because the dish is named for the noodle. And when you spell lasagna with an A, you're saying one noodle. When the word ends in an E, it means more than one. I mean, this is like saying spaghetto, which means one, instead of spaghetti, which means more than one. And those folks that don't believe me, well, just check out a native-born Italian food writer like Marcella Hazan, or any Italian dictionary. Harold McGee is a food scientist with what seems to be endless curiosity about every aspect of food that you could imagine. His book on food and cooking is the Bible of every chef worth his salt. And Harold also does the occasional column for the New York Times under the header of The Curious Cook. Harold, it's good to have you back.
Good to be with you, Lynn.
Harold, I want to talk about heat and how we use it in cooking. What's the most important thing about heat and food?
Well, it seems to me that we all know about how important it is how heat gets into food, but I think it's just as important how it leaves food, and that's something we don't think about that much.
What do you mean by that?
Well, take braising, for example. That's a technique that people have been using for thousands of years, and it produces wonderful results some of the time and not so great results other times. And part of the reason for that inconsistency is, I think, that many cooks don't understand that heat is kind of flowing into the pot and flowing out at the same time. And if you don't control that balance properly, you end up overcooking the food. Even though you're cooking in a very low oven, you can actually overcook it in a matter of minutes.
All right. So braising, which is where you're cooking, let's say, meat, because that's the trickiest, in liquid to barely cover, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're cooking at a low temperature. So what makes it work? Because I've braised where the meat was fall apart tender and still had all its flavor. And I've braised where that same cut of meat ended up being dry and tough. So what is going on when we braise?
Well, probably what happened was that you had the lid on the pot one time and the lid off the pot the other time, or a jar. Because what happens in braising is that you're cooking the meat gently, ideally, because meat gets tough if it's raised above a certain temperature. And so you really want to keep the temperature at 150, 160, 170 degrees, something like that. Boiling water is 212. And if you boil meat, then you get dry meat.
Oh.
And so you put a pot of meat and vegetables and liquid into the oven, and it's a 250-degree oven, and it feels very low, and, you know, you can put your hand in there. It doesn't feel as though it's really warm at all. If you put the lid on that pot, then eventually the inside of that pot is going to reach the boiling point because the oven is 250 degrees. The pot is enclosed. It's going to heat up to as hot as it can get, which is the boiling point, and you're going to end up boiling that meat and turning it into something tough. But if you leave the lid ajar, then heat will be leaving the pot at the same time that it's entering it. It's leaving it because the liquid at the surface of the pot is evaporating. And just as happens when we're perspiring and our skin is cooled by that perspiration, when the pot is in the oven with the lid ajar, liquid at the surface of the pot can evaporate off and cool the contents and keep it at a very moderate temperature, 160, 170 degrees, even though the oven setting is 250.
Now, when you say 160, 170 degrees, is that the internal temperature of the meat or the temperature of the liquid the meat is in?
It's the temperature of the liquid that the meat is in, which is eventually going to become the temperature that the center of the meat is at.
And once it reaches that temperature at the center of the meat, am I done?
No, because what you're trying to do usually in a braise is dissolve the connective tissue, which is tough, into wonderful succulent gelatin.
Yeah.
And that happens over time, gradually. It happens very quickly at the boiling point. It takes more time at 160 or 170 degrees, and that's why you need to compensate for that lower temperature with the lid ajar by leaving it in the oven for a longer time.
I see. Okay. But it's the 160 degrees, and do not let it boil.
Yes.
Okay. Harold, thank you.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Food scientist Harold McGee is author of On Food and Cooking. His column on heat appeared in the January 2nd, 2008 issue of The Times. Now, you'll find that information and many other vital, essential, life-changing thoughts like our newsletter Weeknight Kitchen, our podcasts, and information on our book designed to get you to sit down and eat well with friends and family. It's called How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. Anyway, you're going to find all that at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the end of food and end of failed baking and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Well, considering the present economy, this may not be what you want to hear today or believe, but by many accounts, we Americans have the cheapest food in the Western world. And this is no accident. It's the result of systems that we've honed over two centuries. But journalist Paul Roberts says that those systems and our food supplies are on shaky ground. Paul writes on resource economics and politics for publications like Harper's Magazine and The Washington Post. His latest book is The End of Food. Paul, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Paul, you know, food prices have gone so high. Is it still true that we in the United States have the cheapest food in the Western world, or is that just myth?
Oh, it's true. I mean, for a couple of reasons. We have a system that produces food so efficiently in such high volume that we've just driven down the per unit cost. And we also, you know, we're wealthy. So the percentage of our household income that we spend on food is probably lower than anywhere else in the world. And you put those two factors together, and we are eating cheap.
One of the things that you talk about in the book is the system that creates all of this is broken. Well, what does that mean?
Well, I mean that when you look at the price that you pay for a cob of corn or, you know, pork ribs at the store, that doesn't reflect all the actual cost of making that. It doesn't reflect the safety problems that come up because we're producing food too quickly in these plants. You know, the inspectors can't actually inspect all the food. It doesn't reflect the environmental damage that's done by these industrial, kind of industrial style farming. And you know, those costs are sort of being absorbed by society as a whole or by the environment as a whole, and at some point you have to pay them. And we're seeing declining output as we're sort of destroying our soil.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of costs will come back to haunt us in the sense that they will keep us from producing as much food as we're going to need in the future when we have more people.
What are some of the other ways that we're seeing the system not working anymore?
Well, again, you go back to the notion that we can push a lot of meat through our sort of meat sector. And we have these massive plants. They're heavily automated. We have these enormous feedlots with, you know, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of animals.
Mm-hmm.
And on the upside is that the per unit cost, the per pound cost is tiny. It's a fraction of what it was even 20 years ago. The downside is that, you know, we're moving so much product through the system that we just can't assure the safety anymore. If you look at, you know, the ground beef industry,
mm-hmm.
if one of those batches of ground beef, and we're talking like tons of ground beef, gets contaminated with something like E. coli, it's often very difficult for these plant managers to know where that contamination is, to contain it. It usually spreads through the system so quickly that they have to recall everything. And that's an example of a cost that we're having to address now. You know, as safety problems go up, as consumer confidence in food safety goes down, I think we're recognizing that cheap food, you know, isn't really as cheap as it seemed.
Well, yeah, I realize we seem to be coming close to the real price of gas for our cars. Europe has paid much higher prices historically, and, you know, our prices go up and down, but essentially it's elevated. Do you think we're going to come to the point where we're paying, in quotation marks, the real price of food? And is it going to be skyrocketed compared to what we pay now?
I do think food prices will have to go up to reflect the real cost, and I think we're already starting to see some of that. You know, if you go to the store and look in the alternative section and look for, say, free-range beef, organic chicken, you see the price premium you're going to pay.
Yeah.
That's probably what we're going to see. And it sort of raises this paradox that we haven't had to deal with for a while, and that is, I guess you could call it a calorie gap. You know, for the last 50 years, as we've discovered ways to produce food more industrially, more efficiently, at higher volumes, we've really been able to eradicate hunger in many parts of the world, not mm-hmm. entirely by any means, mm-hmm. but where hunger used to be just this standard, it was one of the four horsemen and it was always there. We've been able to reduce that and really to confine hunger to these fairly specific geographic areas. You know, well, if food prices continue to go up and further, if we're forced to move to a more sustainable food system that is inherently more expensive, we're going to see a return of that hunger gap. And I think the challenge, and by which I mean we're going to see a return to an era where hunger is a major driver for political instability. And one of the huge challenges here for policymakers and for advocates of more sustainable food is to try to find a way to sort of fix the food system without excluding, you know, several billion people.
Is the idea of the sustainable, the local, the organic, you know, the things that we hear of as the great ideal right now, is that going to just either go away, be only something available to the affluent, or is this part of fixing the system?
I think these are pieces of it. These are sort of prototypes. When you look at organic or local, free range, any of these things, I mean, absolutely they are sort of niche products, and they are priced, you know, to effectively exclude a large percentage of the U.S. mm-hmm. population, to say nothing of the rest of the world. That said, I mean, they're sort of pointing the way toward methods, business practices, technologies that could be used more broadly. But in order to get from here to there, we're going to have to come up with some new categories, you know, maybe almost organic, or you know,
yeah.
maybe just a reduction of pesticide use is enough. You know, the idea that we could produce enough food for all of us on a nation of small farms,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds romantic, but it's going to be very tough to do that, not the least because of the huge labor requirements. You know, we have fewer than 1%, I believe, of the American population works on farms, and yet if we were to move back to a model of small farmers, that percentage would have to increase. How do you encourage people to go back to farming?
Yeah. Is there one message you would like to leave the consumer looking at that food that is getting more and more expensive?
I think there isn't one thing that I would tell – this isn't a one-size-fits-all. I think
right.
I would suggest that shoppers stop seeing themselves simply as consumers and reimagine themselves in the role of producers. And by that, I mean you don't necessarily have to go and plow up your yard, although there are worse things you could do.
Right, right, yeah.
You know, but that attitude, I think, is critical. The idea that we're in the sort of the search mode for solutions, and I think pushing that so that finding, you know, for example, if you decided that what you wanted to do was cook, you know, 2 or 3 extra nights a week. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but it actually has an amazing effect. I mean, in terms of your own health and nutrition, you know, you're controlling the ingredients, in terms of your food costs. And think of the sort of the economic signal that you send the system. I mean, right now, the food industry is geared for a certain percentage of people who cook and the vast majority of people who simply buy food that is pre-processed.
Right.
If that number were to shift at all, even marginally, it would force the industry to suddenly find a way to change its business practices. That's the kind of signal, I think, ultimately, that, you know, is going to be much more important to the food industry and to driving change than a lot of hand-wringing about sustainability per se.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, there's nothing really to sell there, and it doesn't sound very tough. It doesn't sound like the kind of action that we need. We want a 10-point plan. But it may be, ultimately, that simply cooking, going back to the kitchen, is you know, at a critical first step.
Paul, thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Paul Roberts is the author of The End of Food. Now, in the spirit of getting us back in the kitchen 1 or 2 nights a week, I've got a weeknight recipe from our book, How to Eat Supper. Check out roasted butternut squash and greens over bowtie pasta. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. For a long time, my favorite bumper sticker has been, "Control is an illusion." Well, it may have to change because of food scientist Shirley Currier's new book. She's written Bakewise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Baking. And let me tell you, from many pathetic experiences, I've discovered firsthand that in baking, if you don't understand the science, you're flying blind. Shirley, it's good to have you back.
I'm thrilled to be here, Lynn. It's always a pleasure.
Well, darling, let's start at the beginning, okay? Literally, what do we have to know when we turn on the oven?
Okay. Number one, you want to preheat the oven. And number two, I love to use a heavy baking stone, one of those big rectangular pizza stones, because this gives you very, very even heating. And you can preheat the oven and get that stone to a set temperature. Then when you open the oven door to put something in,
mm-hmm.
the temperature of the oven drops dramatically, but your stone is going to stay the same temperature. So it's going to give you nice, even cooking. And see, there's a huge fight going on in the oven. The heat from the top... you know how it is, Lynn. I get so carried away.
I know, Jared, but I love it.
Anyhow, heat from the top of the oven starts crusting your baked good, and that crust is going to hold it down. You've got to have heat from the bottom to get the batter hot and get everything going and make steam and get that thing rising like crazy before the heat from the top of the oven sets it. So I just think a good heavy baking stone is a huge secret in baking.
So where do you put the stone? You put the rack very low in the oven, and then you put the stone on the rack?
That's correct.
And then you put your baking pan right on that stone?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk leavening.
Yes.
You know, baking powder, baking soda. How do these things work, and why do we use both in some recipes and only one or the other in other recipes?
Okay. Well, let me jump to the first step of leavening.
Mm-hmm.
Baking powder and baking soda, neither of them make bubbles. What they do is blow up bubbles that are already in the batter. Now, this makes that creaming step, the step where you beat the butter and the sugar, this step is a vital part of leavening. Because what you're doing, when you beat those fine air bubbles into the butter,
mm-hmm.
you are literally creating the bubbles that are going to be enlarged by the baking powder and the baking soda. Once you add the eggs, the game's all over. Those bubbles don't increase the volume of the final cake.
So Shirley, how do we know when we've beaten enough?
Well, number one, you've got cold butter, so it's not going to melt on you.
Right.
And you need to beat, if you've got a good counter mixer, I would say you need to beat about 7 minutes. If you're doing it with a hand mixer, you might want to beat a little longer.
That's a long time, and it's really fluffy then.
Yes, until the butter looks pale and it's fluffy. But when you feel the bowl, it's still cool. You know the batter's cold enough to hold the bubbles.
Great. Okay, so the next step, baking powder, baking soda.
Okay. Baking powder contains exactly the right amount of acid to use up all the soda. 1 teaspoon of baking powder has 1/4 teaspoon of soda, plus 1 or 2 or 3 acids and cornstarch to keep it all dry. But baking soda is just direct leavening. So with baking soda, you have to have something acidic in the batter to react with the baking soda, but also it's going to react instantly. With baking powder, you have more control. You have double or triple action. This is why a lot of people really prefer the baking powder, because of its great reliability and that it does produce leavening at different stages, right after you mix it, and then as it stands a minute, and then in the hot oven. And now the rules are very firm. 1 teaspoon of baking powder per cup of flour in the recipe, an absolute maximum of 1 1/4 teaspoon. I prefer to stick to 1 teaspoon per cup. But with baking soda, you only use 1/4 teaspoon of soda per cup of flour. Now, this is all vital because if you have too much leavening, the bubbles get huge and float to the top and pop. And there goes your leavening. Your cake falls.
And you got hockey pucks.
That's right. Now, you can check in many fine cookbooks, the recipes are over-leavened. And the cake will be much lighter if you correct the amount of leavening. And frequently it's connected to the soda because people don't realize how strong it is. 1 teaspoon of baking soda will leaven 4 cups of flour.
That's a lot of cake.
Yes, it is.
Shirley,
it really, really is.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
You're so welcome.
Food scientist Shirley Currier's latest book is Bakewise, The Hows and Whys of Successful Baking. Now, Shirley left us with a great starter recipe, Dinner on the Grounds Coconut Cake. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. It's time to play Stump the Cook, the Splendid Table refrigerator game. Our game is presided over by our noble stump master, Christopher Kimball. He of Cook's Illustrated and PBS's America's Test Kitchen fame. Chris, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me. This is my favorite thing to do. I don't have to do any of the work.
Well, you have to make a judgment.
That's my favorite thing, too.
So why don't you explain the rules of the game?
Rules are simple. 5 ingredients you have to use to make a dish that everyone wants to eat. You get water, pepper, salt, and some sort of fat as a freebie. And then up to 3 additional ingredients that our contestant actually has on hand.
And the 5 ingredients are from our contestant's refrigerator, and I have no idea what's coming.
No, and you're always surprised.
Very much so. So who's up?
With Meredith from Baltimore. Meredith, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Hi, Meredith.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
So what's in your fridge?
All right. Well, I have kale, water crackers, lemon hummus.
Wait a minute. Water crackers.
Yep.
Lemon hummus,
yes.
Ooh, okay.
2 plums.
Ooh.
And cottage cheese.
Is the cottage cheese fuzzy or is it good?
You know what? It's actually good, and that's surprising for us.
Okay, so it's kale, water crackers, lemon hummus, 2 plums, and cottage cheese. That's 5 ingredients.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Sure. Okay.
You're stalling. You're stalling.
You're telling me I'm stalling. Why me? All right. Okay. I think we've got this down pat here. All right. The kale is begging to be poached. okay? You know, you're going to, in so many words, you're going to remove the stems from the kale, drop it in boiling salted water, and you're going to cook it until it's very tender.
Okay.
And then what you're going to do is you're going to puree that into the hummus with some extra olive oil. That's the fat that's free, right?
Yep, we have that.
Okay. And you're going to... You're going to just puree.
Then you're going to go out for dinner.
Then you are going to slice those plums into thin wedges. You're going to take a little more olive oil, heat it in a skillet, toss those plums in with garlic.
Okay.
All right. And brown them nicely. And then add a little vinegar to the pan. So that's two ingredients. You have garlic, right?
Yes, I do have garlic.
And have you got some kind of vinegar?
You know what? I do. I think it's just balsamic. Hope that's okay.
You know what? That'll be good. It's sweet. That's
$200 a bottle. It's the aged stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, then four
you
drops.
You know what? Unfortunately, we're poor out of college, so it's generic. I'm sorry, Lynn.
That's fine. Trust me. So you're going to boil that down until it's like a syrup.
Okay.
With those plums, with the garlic. And the third ingredient is going to be a shot of hot chili. It can be chili flakes, it can be Tabasco, it can be hot sauce. All right? So you want sweet, hot, garlicky.
Okay, great.
Do you have some hot sauce?
Yes, I think we do. I think we have a little Tabasco.
Right. Whatever form it is, it's got to be hot and chili-like.
Okay.
Now, what you're going to do is you're going to blend that into the hummus. It's going to add a whole different kind of dimension of flavor. And with
ain't kidding.
Yeah, but with all that kale in there, it's going to really taste fabulous. So the idea is you spread that on the water cracker and you top it with just a little bit of the creamy cottage cheese, which is like your neutral. It's like instead of sour cream or whole milk yogurt. And that's it. And it's sort of a spicy, sweet, medieval Arab influenced.
Oh, boy. You're going to love it. It's going to taste great.
And if you like that, I've got a bridge I can sell you. All right, Meredith, so what do you think?
You know, it's very interesting.
It's the garlic and the plums that I have a little trouble with here. What do you think, Meredith? I say it's a no-go. I thought it was a valiant attempt, but I say no.
All right.
Sorry, Lynn.
That's all right.
Okay. It was a terrific attempt.
Don't worry, Meredith. Just don't bother calling ever again. All right. It's all right.
This podcast, I promise, from now on.
Hey, Meredith, though, thanks for playing.
Thank you very much.
I'm
going to
be
Meredith.
A good sport. Thank you.
Bye.
And Chris, I know you're going to stride home feeling marvelous after this.
You do the best job of anybody I know. It's just I'm not eating kale hummus with garlic plums, but, you know, that's just me.
Thanks for playing, Chris.
My pleasure.
You too can play Stump the Cook. Leave us a message at 800-537-5252, and one of our cunning producers may be in touch. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, this week, the question is, what is a Hoover hog? And we're going to be back in a moment with that answer, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is a Hoover hog? Well, it's an armadillo. And okay, I'm going to explain. Herbert Hoover was the president at the beginning of the Depression that started in 1929. His policies failed miserably. And when destitute Southern sharecroppers were forced to survive on wild armadillo, they dubbed the animal Hoover hog. And yes, people say it tastes rich and good, like pork. Now, I think we should know more about the armadillo. In Latin America, it is held in high regard. Aztecs called it turtle rabbit. The armadillo especially likes ants and termites for dinner. It comes out at night. It's not very social, but it nurses its young. And one species actually can float. It can inflate its innards, and it can float across streams. And to get the best out of your armadillo in the kitchen, think barbecue, grilling, chili, or pan-fried in butter. The lines are officially open. We're getting ready to take your calls, brought to you by Palm Wonderful. 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. Now you can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is calling. We have got Josh calling from Tulsa. Josh, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I was wanting to talk about frittatas and kind of what they are.
Uh-huh.
And I had one for the first time, which is amazing to me, last week.
Right.
And I think I kind of was curious how it was made, and I kind of watched her make it a little, but
yeah.
I didn't really know. It was like potatoes were involved in there somewhere.
Was this someone doing a Spanish recipe?
It was. It was, in fact, it was a frittata.
Yeah.
And then we put lentils on top of it and green olives.
Oh.
And it was delicious.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. In Spain, a frittata can be called a tortilla.
Okay.
It's a matter of language. But essentially what a frittata is it's a thick omelet. And the way you make it is whatever the filling will be, in the case it might be potatoes, for instance, you generally sauté it and flavor it. So it could be any kind of vegetable you would like it to be. It could be leftover bits of meat. It could be leftover cooked veggies or beans or grains even. Now, in Spain, the classic is doing it with slices of potato. And a way to speed it up is you boil the potato first, even if you cook it halfway, and then you thin slice it and you start to brown it very lightly in a bit of olive oil with some salt and pepper. And then the thing is that you beat up eggs, and this is where a nonstick skillet is helpful. You know, I don't normally talk about how I don't waste my time on nonstick, but it's really going to make this easier to do. There are two ways of doing it. You always start the same way. You make that base sauté and you make it taste good with whatever seasoning you like. Then you beat up eggs. And I think you saw there are probably quite a few eggs, right?
I didn't see how many.
But how thick was this? Probably about 2 inches, an inch and a half maybe?
It was almost 3 inches.
Yeah, that's pretty typical. So you maybe have 6, 7, 8 eggs in there. It may have a little water in with the eggs. But the point is you beat up those eggs. You pour them into the hot pan with the filling in the pan, okay? And you let that cook over medium to medium-low heat. Cook it slow because you want those eggs to remain tender. And you do that until you can take a knife or a little spatula and pull the frittata away from the side of the pan. It's firm enough at the bottom, okay? Now, there's two ways of dealing with it at this point. The way they do it traditionally is that you're supposed to gently shuffle that out of the pan onto a plate, okay, and to cook the top of the frittata, you're to put that hot skillet over the top of the plate and flip this thing upside down back into it. Do not do that.
She stuck hers in the oven,
I think. This is a very wise woman. Take it from a woman who has gotten scalded, burned, all in the name of authenticity. And finally I said, feh, this is not going to work. So have your oven on. You can even run it under the broiler, but generally it's nice to have your oven on at around 350 because the slower you cook eggs, the more juicy and tender they're going to be. I know that sounds weird to talk about a juicy egg, but you know how eggs can sometimes be like rubber?
Yeah.
It's because they've been cooked too fast. Because these little things are really delicate. So 350, maybe 400 degrees. And when the top looks firm, but when you stick a knife in, the center is just clinging a little bit, take it out of the oven and let it just sit for 5 or 10 minutes. You can serve it at room temperature too, but it'll finish cooking and it will be perfectly cooked. And if you were to sprinkle a little cheese on top of that as it was coming out of the oven to melt into it. But the lentils sound unbelievable. What a brilliant way to do this. I mean, it's fabulous.
It was really good.
Yeah. So that's how you do it. It's not hard, and you don't have to stand over it every minute. But you need a good thick pan that holds the heat well. And you need a wide pan and a fair amount of eggs.
Okay.
So enjoy, Josh. Thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
You take care. Frittatas are great because they can take anything. They can take leftovers. They can take bits and pieces. You know, a stir fry, yeah, you can put that in eggs. And by the way, leftover pasta browned lightly in the pan, it's sauce and all, and then you break eggs into it. A classic from southern Italy, a pasta, essentially a pasta frittata. Fabulous. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Beth on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Beth, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you, Lynn?
I am very good, ma'am, and you're in one of my favorite parts of the world.
Well, come see us again sometime.
I would be delighted. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a burning question.
Burning question. All right, yeah.
Living in the South, it seems like so many recipes, and including some of my family's favorites, have an ingredient in there called condensed soup.
Yeah.
And I'd love to just try to find another way to get around that, maybe healthier ingredients I have on hand.
You know, the South has not cornered the market on this. Do you know that Campbell's first invented cream of mushroom soup, and I think their cream of chicken, to be sauces?
No.
Yeah, that's what I remember reading somewhere. But, you know, if you think about it, you know what it really is? It's a bechamel sauce.
Right.
So you've got equal parts of butter and flour that you cook together in a saucepan with a whisk so that you make sure there's no lumps. You pour in warm milk, maybe nutmeg. If you want to get fancy, you take an onion and you stick cloves in it, you know, like a wedge of onion.
Right.
And some chopped carrot and some chopped celery and a bay leaf. This is getting very fancy. But the point is, you put in the hot milk, you whisk it until it's smooth, and you let that simmer slowly until it thickens and until it has no raw flour taste. And one of the tricks to get that sauce to taste really fabulous is to put in more milk than you might normally do it and let it cook longer with those ingredients. They're called aromatics that I mentioned, and the sauce takes on an even nicer flavor. And if you don't have milk, or if you want to do it as a meatier kind of thing, you can do like half broth and half milk. So that's the base. You add a lot of sauteed mushrooms to that, and maybe even some dried mushrooms that you've soaked and you use their liquid as well as sautéing in the mushrooms, and you've got cream of mushroom soup. You do it with chicken broth and cream or milk and chunks of chicken, and you've got cream of chicken soup. So, and you do it with a vegetable, and you got cream of that vegetable soup. Mm-hmm. So that's the base, and it's that roux, that flour and butter, that makes it a thickener, so it gives body to a dish. So that's how you could do it yourself. And you use a ton of mushrooms, use a lot of whatever you're flavoring it with.
And is there a way to make it a little healthier?
Well, first of all, you're not using the chemicals and the preservatives.
Right.
Number two, I mean, you could go the whole organic route, depending on your opinions in that area. You could use skim milk. You could use a very, you know, a small amount of cream goes a very long way in making something feel creamy.
Okay.
Like you could use really good tasting broths. Use that as the liquid. Cook that. Let the flour thicken it. Add just a little cream at the end. And pile in those vegetables.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a couple of ways of doing it.
All right.
And can I offer one other suggestion that will be even healthier?
Yes.
If a vegetable has any kind of starch potential.
Okay.
Okay. You could cook it with whatever seasonings you like cauliflower cooked with curry powder and onion and garlic, okay, in broth. Puree that and add a little bit of cream.
Mm.
And it tastes like a cream soup. You could also do that with mushrooms. So you skip the flour, you
right.
skip the extra butter, and this is up. Now you've got a puree of vegetables. It doesn't hold up as well,
but it is much healthier, and it's so intense in flavor, you just can't get over it.
Yeah, okay.
And a potato thrown in is also a binder. It thickens. So you can, you see, so there's a lot of ways to get this baby to work.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lynn.
Hey, Beth, thank you. And I'll come back to Chapel Hill.
Yes, please.
You take care, girl.
All right, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. When it comes to what wine to drink with what food, we've been so Eurocentric, and I guess it makes sense since wine culture came from there. But America no longer lives on steak and Cabernet. We're eating easily in 100 different languages, and many of them are Asian. Now, I think those incredibly varied Asian flavors toss a lot of old wine rules right out the window, which is where Edwin Soon enters the picture. He's a Singapore-based wine authority who trains sommeliers throughout Southeast Asia, and he's author of the newly published Pairing Wine with Asian Food. Edwin Soon, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
So, Edwin, do you think that Asian cuisines kind of toss those old European-based rules of wine and food out the window?
Some of it needs to be relooked at. Certainly, Asian food's not too spicy or not too savory, nor too foreign to make a liaison with wines, because there's so many different varieties of wines. But when you're dining on Asian food, normally you have two or three different dishes with various flavors all served together.
Yes, that's right. So you have all these contrasts. Could we, how do you like to approach the pairing with when you have a table full of different dishes?
Well, the easiest way is to find a wine that's versatile enough to handle various types of flavors. Normally, that's not the case, so you need at least two wines, perhaps one red and one white,
right.
And you should be quite happy at the table.
I'm thinking of some of the primary tastes that you might find in Asian dishes.
Yeah.
So, and could we talk about how you might pair wines with those? For instance, chili hot dishes. I mean, are there any wines that can ride with the impact of hot pepper on the palate?
Yeah. I think the piquant taste of chili is one thing you really have to consider when you're matching wine with Asian food, because if you pick wines that are too high in alcohol, then you actually accentuate the chili taste. So the best types of wine for food with lots of chili is to pick something that's lightly sweet. So you could go for a Muscat or Moscato or maybe a late harvest white wine.
So red wines would probably not work at all.
Not workable. Another possibility is a dry white wine. And I learned this really from my mother-in-law, who's Thai, because when her curries were too hot, I said, maybe I should add a little sugar. And she says, no, you don't. Sugar works, but you don't need to. You can actually squeeze some lime and some lemon into the curry.
Right.
And that helps to tone down the chili taste. So in the same way, you can actually use a dry white wine to cleanse your palate between each mouthful of hot chili taste.
What about I'm thinking of the Vietnamese soups. Pho, the great beef noodle soup with vegetables, is so complex. Would you even drink a wine with that?
Okay, I must admit I've been stumped there. We've tried various wines with pho, and I've never been able to find a good match. I think pho should be best enjoyed on its own.
Just stand on its own.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, it is so nice to hear a wine authority say, you know, I haven't figured it out, and maybe it's just not going to work.
Well, you know, some things you just can't push.
Right. One last question. I'm thinking of Chinese braised dishes, things that are rich with that quality of soy sauce. What works best with those kinds of dishes?
So with those dishes, you've got savory taste, and braising brings out all the rich flavors. Now, with those, you can actually borrow from the Western pairing principles. I think you could use a nice red wine with a little bit of tannin. That should work, because at the end of the day, you're not, with Asian food, you're not matching the meat or the fish or the chicken that's used. What you're matching is the sauce or the cooking method.
Well, Edwin, thank you so much. That's a great guideline. Think the sauce and not necessarily the main ingredient.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Lynn. It was nice talking to you.
Edwin Soon is a Singapore-based wine authority. His latest book is Pairing Wine with Asian Food. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Lin Yutang. Our lives are not in the lap of the gods, but in the lap of our cooks. Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find priceless newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our must-have book, How to Eat Supper, Recipes, Stories, and Opinions. And that title says it all. So check it all out online, splendidtable.org. Our show is supported in part by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by Gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. You can join the conversation on cooking at Gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.